bail out New York. You're not bailing out New York. New York has bailed you out. Every year, it's bailed you out. Mitch McConnell is a taker, not a giver. New York is a state of givers. We put more money into the federal pot every year. We're the number one state in donating to the federal pot. Number one. Kentucky is the number three state in taking from the federal pot.
I like how Andrew Cuomo there had to talk slower so Mitch McConnell could understand.
Yeah.
People in Kentucky. Hi, everyone. That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on Friday expressing irritation that Senate Majority Leader Cocaine Mitch McConnell didn't include in the latest federal money helicoptering exercise a bailout for battered state and local governments. Hello, boys and girls. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nicholas B. Peter Suderman and Catherine Mangue Ward. G'day, mates.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy
hey,
Monday.
Matt. Some COVID-19 bullet points to get us in the imagery of guns. U.S. deaths from the coronavirus are now above 55,000. That's up from 42,000 a week ago. Worldwide deaths are north of 200,000. Confirmed cases in the world are 3 million in the U.S., 1 million, which is up from 750,000 last Monday. Good news being that the curve is flattened. The bad news is that it's more like a plateau than the downside of a bell curve or a Bill Johnson movie from 1980, which means that death counts are again beginning to exceed the more influential models out there. As the debate continues to move on toward questions of reopening parts of the economy and the country, the Congressional Budget Office on Friday came out with some just brutal short-term numbers, including...
Love those guys. Just want to be clear. I'm a huge fan.
I'm sorry
you
that
do?
I didn't insert a Peter Suderman porn joke there, but he inserted himself. Unemployment north of 10% still by the end of 2021, according to the CBO's projections, and a budget deficit this year for $3.7 trillion, which is nominally, I think, the same amount that the entire federal government spent in 2009 or 10. It is untrue that the CBO illustrated their report with a picture of a dog with a hat on drinking coffee in a room on fire, by the way. Fact check that. There's more grim factlets, but I want to get back to that slow-talking Andrew Cuomo quote, since I think it tees up a whole bunch of conversations that we'll be having not just today on the Reason Roundtable podcast, but also for the ensuing months, maybe years, maybe decades, but then we'll all be dead. Catherine, New York is a net contributor to the federal government. Cuomo is right that states can't declare bankruptcy, as he says in the longer clip, which I encourage people to go look at. The city is the epicenter of the epi-pandemic. So why shouldn't the federal government, as part of spending $18 kajillion, throw some of it on our heroic first responders in New York? What kind of monster are you?
I am at least two or three kinds of monsters, but I will go with the my usual unfeeling robot variant today. OK, so first of all, didn't Mitt Romney like lose the presidency for expressing this same sentiment, but on the individual level? Like, remember when he got in huge trouble for being like, some people pay into the system and some people get payments out of the system and those people have different stakes and investment in said system? And everyone was like, how dare? And then Mother Jones got like 10 bazillion new subscribers and then we didn't have President Mitt Romney, which I know Nick and I disagree about whether that would have been overall better than the timeline we're living in. But this is...
I don't even know which side of the argument I'm on in that one.
Yeah.
It seems so long ago.
Yeah, that's fair. But right. So like even in that short clip, which was part of a much longer and more meandering thought...
Airing of Festivus-like grievances.
Festivus-like grievances. You know, Cuomo perfectly embodies the very, very confused attitude that we have about states' contributions to the federal government and have had since the founding era, right? Like, that is some Federalist Papers shit. That is some very, very, that is a conflict that is very central to the United States and its relationships to the states. I have been more so than ever before in my life team federalism these days. And I think dumping a whole bunch of federal money into New York or doing the calculus of who paid in and who gets to pay out will end badly. And we should instead, not in the way of Donald Trump saying, sorry, you guys should have planned for this pandemic, screw you all, but just in the way of further future budgetary calculations, I don't think the answer is, hey, New York paid in a lot before, we deserve our chunk now. That's not the right rationale. But that I was just, only one of like four that
Terry,
Cuomo offered.
Terry Schiavo, thank you for your belief in federalism.
I just want to express my regret that Cuomo didn't use the words looter and moocher in talking. Yeah. I think that would have really
there
just scrambled all
you
the
know,
eggs.
A couple things on it, though. One is, you know, this is further proof that, in fact, all of Mario Cuomo's kids are Fredos. It's not just Chris, the basement dweller. It's also the guy in the big house up in Albany. We spent, at last count, like what are we at? Like $2.5 trillion on federal aid in response to the coronavirus.
It's 2.8, close to 2.9.
Okay. On its way to 4, 5, 10 trillion, whatever. Cuomo is right about one thing, which is that in the most recent stimulus package, where there's like $150 billion, and I'm using stats pulled together by Reason Foundation, the policy wonks who work for the same nonprofit as we do, $150 billion is going to the states, but there is a proviso that every state gets a certain amount, regardless of how few people live there. And, you know, this works out to Wyoming getting $2,160 per capita and New York getting just $389 per capita. So, you know, yeah, there's reason to be outraged. Not that Andrew Cuomo needs another reason to be angry. But the larger question here is, you know, what are the states supposed to be doing? And do they have rainy day funds? And are they draining those first? I mean, this is on a larger level, you know, the airline shouldn't be bailed out. And Cuomo goes on a long rant about, you know, you're bailing out these corporations and this. What about the states? And it's like, you know, none of it is good. And New York should first and foremost, and all of the other states, especially because they're actually begging for their pension funds to be bailed out, like they should take care of their costs first. And we can wait a while before the federal government has to start shoveling money. And then it should do it, you know, in a more efficacious manner, perhaps. But
let's bookmark that pension discussion, because I want to ask more about that in a moment. But I want to get to some of the health policy aspects, since we have CBO lover Peter Suderman on the horn here. Peter, Catherine, in her heartless federalist monster role there, is all talking about states' rights and such. But this virus knows no borders, Peter. You don't need a passport to be a virus. So there's a role.
It's even infecting kittens these days.
Exactly. Big tiger kitties. But let's presume here, is there not a role for the federal government in a federal response to the virus? And so my question to you, Peter, is not that, although that sounded like a question, but
Matt,
it is
very similar to
that.
A question.
You do that to Peter every time.
He deserves it. Look at him. The question is, what in the 2.8, whatever the hell it is, trillion dollars that the Johnny Fed has been throwing out in the world so far has actually gone towards like health policy response type things?
So it's worth going through all of the different responses briefly here and looking at what they funded and what they didn't. So we started on March 6th with phase one. Remember, we're in like phase 74. This is like the Marvel Universe, right? We're moving into phase four right now. So we started with phase one on March 6th, which was not that long ago. And that was basically just $8 billion for vaccine research. I think we can fairly call that healthcare spending. Then March 14th, just over a week later, we get another bill, phase two. This one adds about $192 billion to the deficit. It's mostly a paid leave bill, but there's also a couple of billion dollars that goes into public health and social services emergency funds, paying claims for providers for the detection of the virus or the or diagnosis of the virus, stuff like that. So testing. So you get another $1 billion there in this $192 billion deficit adding bill. Then, March 25th through March 27th, you get to phase three. This is basically Avengers Endgame of coronavirus relief bills. This is the big one, $2.3 trillion. And of that, about $185 billion is for health providers. And that's split a whole bunch of different ways. There's a $1.3 billion for community health centers. It suspends a Medicare payment reduction that has been left over from sequestration. You guys remember sequestration?
Wow.
It was still happening.
That's a deep cut.
In there, right. And it does a bunch of other payment tweaks that are, just so you understand how boring they are, I'm going to read this to you. Discharges of Medicare beneficiaries.
I think we can empathize.
Who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 during this emergency time, the weighting factor of the diagnosis-related group to which the discharge is assigned will be increased by 20%. Also, it authorizes a temporary increase in federal Medicaid assistance percentages. So that's FMAP. Basically, that's the formula by which the federal government decides to pay for how much of the state's share of a Medicaid spending, the federal government is going to pay for. So that's kind of healthcare spending there. And so that's the big one. That's phase three. And then in phase, let's call it 3B, the add-on, which we passed just last week.
Is this like Ant-Man and the Wasp, Peter?
I would say it's like Black Widow.
Let's grind
it
into
dust. It's like Black Widow.
It
is. It's some backstory that's adding on to what we are. You know, like Black Widow's a prequel, as I understand it. Because spoiler alert, she died in the Avengers movies. So that one.
Yeah, back of the line.
That one has about $25 billion for coronavirus testing, $75 billion for hospitals, much of which is targeted at rural providers who are already struggling before the viral apocalypse. And
Peter is like a budgetary Scheherazade, right? Are you afraid if you stop talking that you'll die?
I feel like I'm like the budgetary Kevin Feige, right? Like the guy who runs the MCU.
You're not
here.
Wrong.
You know, and it's just sort of like he's not making any of those movies. He's just sort of kind of constantly keeping tabs on them and suggesting what they might do a little bit better here or there and making more plans. And so out of this $2.9 trillion or so that we have spent already, we're just getting started, about $294 billion, give or take, my math might be just a little bit off, I am a journalist, has been earmarked for hospitals, healthcare, testing, vaccines, stuff like that. Most of the money that we have spent so far, the vast majority of it, has gone to checks, unemployment benefits, which is just another form of checks, and loans for businesses.
Catherine, beyond just reminding me never to ask Peter another question.
That was great. Shut your face.
No, it was phenomenal. He was trying to out-answer any answer in the history of answering. As I mentioned before, we're bookmarking the pension part of the conversation that Nick brought up and the rainy day funds.
So why are we talking about it now?
Because we bookmarked it.
That's what you do with a bookmark.
Pulled it out.
So we're not engaging with what Peter just said. We're going right to the pension.
And then go learn about the MCU of coronavirus response. And then Matt gets really frustrated when I explain why we're doing it that way.
No, it's actually that was very helpful information. I think we're all digesting it. And we can also use the opportunity to think about the ways, as bracketed by the opening comments from Andrew Cuomo, the ways that states are going to the federal government in a time of crisis to say, how dare you not fund our public sector pensions, which is something that we saw in the great financial crisis of 2008-2009. A Reason Foundation back then, and also in the magazine, did some work to show that basically in the half decade run up to that financial crisis, state governments had essentially doubled. I think it was 80% adjusted for inflation and population increased their spending. So when it wasn't a rainy day. They're like, cool, let's renegotiate all those pension contracts in a way that we have to pay more and promise more that we can't possibly do. And then when the bad day came, they're like, dude, you have to give us all the money. And President Obama did. I mean, essentially, one of the bits of the stimulus, a huge chunk of it, was just like, we're going to pay school teachers and make sure that no one gets fired. So, Catherine, the foundation does a lot of pension work and pre-rainy day pension work. Can you talk a little bit about that and how we should think about it as we see the unfolding season of bailout proposals to the states?
Yeah, I mean, we are definitely going to have a pension chapter in the bailout proposal novel. Sorry. And this is like a real problem where the numbers are just so comically large everywhere and always. So what we are talking about right now, according to a recent foundation study, is something between $1.5 and $2 trillion of cumulative pension debt by the end of the year. So again, everything has a T. There are no numbers that start with billion. God forbid we should talk about millions. $1.5 to $2 trillion. This is an absolutely astronomical sum.
And it's approaching what Mike Bloomberg spent on his presidential campaign.
Right, exactly. And this is, you know, in some cases, I think it is fair to say, you know, maybe there weren't sunny days for this industry or that industry or this person or that person, but there really were good times for these pension funds. There really were just years and years and years where they could have been solving the problem of their own pension liabilities, and they just so deeply didn't do that.
And the problem, to interject, is that, broadly speaking, and you'll correct me where I'm wrong, is that they made extravagant defined benefit promises based on annualized, you know, stock return percentages that were unreasonable, as opposed to making defined contribution and then like most of the rest of us who have private sector retirements do. Go on.
Right. And the problem is, I think, is actually less the defined benefit than it is the extravagance in that. I mean, defined benefit plans, I think, overall are not a good idea for states for lots of reasons. But more important is that they built all of these models based on very optimistic assumptions and very generous benefits to the participants. But it's also very different state to state. And so this is, I think, gets us back to this opening quote from Cuomo, because it's going to be not just all of the state pensions need bailing out and they get together and they ask for bailouts. Some are so much more screwed than others that it's going to create a very elaborate fight about who deserves more and who needs more. The New Jersey teachers pension system right now has something like 30% of the assets it's going to need to cover its long-term costs. So that's an unfunded liability of more than $40 billion. That's just the New Jersey teachers' pensions, right? And then you take that and multiply it across specific pensions in specific states. And I, again, can't help but imagine that we're going to have kind of an all-out war along the lines of what Cuomo was sort of attempting to pick there, unless everyone just gets bailed out ad infinitum, which is the solution Congress has been pursuing so far.
What happens if nobody gets bailed out?
Yeah, that sounds great, but I don't think that's going to happen. So.
No, I mean, you know, I agree. I mean, one of the things that is particularly frustrating about the pension part of this is, as Catherine was saying, like, you know, we just, what are we coming off of? A decade of uninterrupted economic growth. And all that did was build in bigger and bigger pension problems. There is no fixing this. And this is a tough thing to do. And Trump is incapable of doing it. I think Mitch McConnell, I think the current political reality might be incapable of doing this. But it's like, we need a reset, you know, and it's the functional equivalent of a bankruptcy where you tear up long existing expectations and even contracts and say, no, we're starting over. The reason pension people, you know, point out again and again how with relatively modest and minor adjustments away from the current state of defined benefit plans to defined contribution, you can get your states back, in a footing that is feasible. But I mean, this is the moment. Like, you know, where it's like, you can't keep bailing this out. There's a New Jersey state senator and an Illinois state senator who are pushing for a law that would give the federal government the ability to make massive loans to states like New Jersey and Illinois that are, you know, way up the creek. And it's like, it's got to stop. It's got to stop at some point, because it otherwise it is compounding. I for a variety of reasons, I'm thinking again about generational justice. And it's like, man, if you're under 40, you are so screwed, and the pain hasn't even started yet. Because it's going to be all of that spending down the road that chops your economic growth off at the knees.
We've just all agreed, right, though, that like we are going to borrow money until the financial apocalypse hits.
I mean, this is, how do you build a political consensus? Because there are these weird moments that, you know, there was the moment at the federal level after World War II, very different set of circumstances and a triumphant circumstance, but where federal spending, you know, was just slashed overnight in a dramatic way, in a good way. There are other things like base closing, army base closing, things where you get everybody in a room and you admit that something has to change and nobody gets to walk out before that. I mean, we need to build towards a political consensus about, you know, retirements, public pensions in particular. And there's a whole host of kind of quasi-public, whether it's unions or, you know, big industries like the automobile industry, where the automobile manufacturers own the pension liabilities for the unions, et cetera. Like, all of this stuff is coming due. And there's no way around it.
I mean, there are additional problems as well. Illinois, which has requested about $44 billion in pension-related bailouts recently, you know, has a clause in its constitution which basically guarantees public employees an eternal, you know, lifelong right to the pension as defined by the formula that is in effect when they took the job. And the courts have pretty consistently upheld maximalist versions of that. I believe New York has something similar. And so there are sort of court and state constitutional issues that need to be resolved with this, too. It's not quite as simple as, you know, a state legislature just changing the formula or changing the law for today. I mean, in some ways, you could say, well, maybe that's the way it was, and we'll leave it that way for people who are already in the system, or have already sort of started along that path, and we want to change things for people going forward. But there are constitutional and court issues that come up here that complicate this already complicated political matter.
And I would just hasten to point out, following up on Nick's, I think, kind of big picture comment of that there's no fixing this, smaller picture there is. And the Reese Foundation has been working on that and successfully working on pension reform packages at various states and have done good work and make places more fiscally responsible. But that is, you know, some work right before a tsunami that's coming our way, which is really rough to think about. Nick, I want to follow up with you about a cultural bit and then go back to Peter on more pension-ish type of things. But
I think that the proper superhero cinematic universe to be comparing things to is actually the DC universe, Matt.
Thank you.
Where it just sort of collapsed, and they've done like three or four resets and basically put Ben Affleck out of business in the process.
I think the secret to all of this is in Birds of Prey, a close reading of the director's cut of Birds of Prey.
You're not wrong, and also not right. But no, Catherine has kind of teased out the sort of culture, regional, state versus state, spy versus spy war that might be coming to a head. And I want to ask you about that, since you occupy a interesting position as someone who has defended cosmopolitan capitals like the one that you live in as zones of freedom, if not quite necessarily polities that are governed with anything like sanity, let alone getting a high marks on whatever freedom index is coming. Given the Cuomo versus McConnell thing, given the pensions, which tend to hit blue states, and New Jersey and Illinois more than they do in Arizona or purple states, whatnot. Do you fear for our how this is going to play out politically? Do you think it's just going to exacerbate those city mouse versus country mouse tendencies in American politics?
Oh, Yeah, I guess so. And if so, it means that the country mouse eventually loses. They'll have a good long run and they're partly in it. But the populations are in the cities and especially the suburbs around the cities. So Kentucky, yeah, it has two senators, but it will lose to, you know, the combined might of all of the other big states that have a lot more Congress people and a lot more population. But yeah, everything, I think one of the most kind of both predictable and depressing aspects of the pandemic is that, you know, I mean, there's that beautiful dream, right, that underwrites the Watchmen, where if we are facing an invasion by a giant squid from outer space, like we'll all get together. And it's like, no, actually, we will fight for each tentacle that we can take from somebody else's mouth, even if we don't want it. And this is just polarizing, you know, everything, every bad tendency in political polarization that was in place 6 months ago is now, you know, on steroids with coronavirus.
Suderman, cheer us up by telling us a little bit about how screwed our old age promises are on a federal level. Last week, we had the Social Security Administration release a report that was grim reading even prior to the pandemic. Can you talk us a little bit about how the looming economic problems, governmental problems, and et cetera problems will affect our promises to Nick and all the other old people?
Yeah, so I don't know which is more screwed, the Hollywood superhero movie industrial complex or our social security system. It's a close call at this point, because right now the whole problem for the movie industry is that nobody's going to the movies. There are no movie theaters open. Even if they opened the movie theaters, there wouldn't be any movies to play in them, and people would still be scared to go out to them. And so they are looking at losses of 40% for this year in the best case scenario. And Social Security is kind of the same. There's just not enough money and not enough people. And so even before the coronavirus pandemic ruined everything, including superhero movies for everyone, we were about $2 trillion short over the next decade, and Social Security was going to be not bankrupt, but insolvent in 2035 or so by the latest estimates. And that's not very long from now. That means that if you are in your early 50s, you can expect to not retire with full Social Security benefits. That means that people who are in the system would take something like a 20% cut or so, because as we have discussed many times before on this podcast and in the pages of Reason Magazine and the pixels of Reason.com, the whole thing about Social Security is that most people think it's a savings program. It is not. It is a generational transfer program in which today's workers funnel money to today's retirees. And so that money that is being taken out of your paycheck is not being saved for you. You are not getting it back. Instead, it is going directly to today's retirees. And when there are not enough people working to pay for the retirees who are in the system, because today's retirees live much longer than they did when Social Security was passed into law. In fact, on average, when Social Security was passed into law, most retirees, if I understand this correctly, most retirees did not make it to 65 at all. And so it was truly a program for people who were late in life, unusually so, and were more likely to be quite needy. And now it has just turned into a transfer program from young workers to old retirees. There's not enough money to fund it. There's going to be even less now that we have now that we've taken the economy offline for at least a couple of months and possibly much longer, and spent probably going on $4 trillion in relief funds in an effort to try and prop things up while the economy is in a coma.
Catherine, I just, what metaphors do you use, since you don't use superhero movies? I just want you to talk, because I know you won't reference.
Is there
a
Little House book called, like, you know, Pandemic on the Prairie or something?
Some science fiction crap.
Some science fiction crap. No, my family has been in lieu of doing our actual state ordered homeschooling, we've mostly just been reading Greek myths at my house, which is a totally legitimate alternative.
So, like Wonder Woman.
first of all, yes, Wonder Woman is the gateway drug to Greek myths, 100%. Yes. And so sorry, Matt, you lose because it's all superheroes in the end, although not that batch. The other batch, I know they're different, blah, blah, blah. But the, you know, the sort of grumpy, angry, vengeful, inconstant pantheon.
I can hear you.
Wow, that was too real for me on like 8 levels.
Yeah.
You know, that is like really kind of helping me understand our politics right now. That's my metaphor, is like Donald Trump is like Zeus on a bad day and Andrew Cuomo is out here being, I don't know, I suppose he's either like Hades or maybe like Hermes, depending on which side you're on. And
wait, isn't he like Aquaman? Is it the one who's Aquaman?
Aquaman is not a god.
Neptune. Poseidon.
Yes. He could be Poseidon.
Let's
go with the Roman gods for Cuomo, please.
That's a good point.
But basically the point is like no one actually has the best interests of humanity in mind. And instead, they're all busy with their own garbage. And we mere mortals are suffering for it. How's that for another metaphor?
That's helpful, actually, because we're having a similar, although not as strenuous, story arc in our family with the Greeks and the Romans. Let's get a little bit to the reopen debates, since that continues to be a source of a lot of conversation, including Chris Christie reinserting himself into the national debates.
Oh, my God. Reinserting himself. There's not enough, you know, lube in the world for him to reinsert himself into a public debate, Matt.
Nicholas Gillespie, you go to your room.
Wow. So
don't blame me. I voted for Kodos.
Okay.
So anywho, we're still trying to figure out how the coronavirus works. There's been a lot of studies out, kind of overlapping, conflicting with one another. Obviously different politicians have said different things at different times, which is all euphemistically, portrayed, but, preliminarily it seems like the great outdoors and the sunny sunshine are kind of good. Preliminarily, it seems that if you are a young and healthful Ute, as opposed to a gimpy old, you have a fraction of the mortality risk about all of this. And also, and this is kind of anecdotal, perhaps, people who are pinned inside with their families going through Zoom meetings with their 5-year-olds are losing their minds and are about to commit crimes. Nick, do we know enough with all of that to start letting people go outdoors without government authorization?
You know, we don't know, you know, much of anything, but I think we're reaching a point where we need to start reopening different parts of society. And I think, you know, we saw that with Georgia on Friday, and then today they're opening up certain parts of things. We'll see how that works. Andrew Cuomo himself is talking about opening up parts of New York's economy and kind of social life, you know, in a week or two. Yeah, it makes sense, you know, and they're with limited knowledge. We know, you can't sustain a society with the lockdown that we generally have in place now. The United States, I think, is well positioned to allow for different states and different localities to try different things. And, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, the best things will become evident relatively quickly. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and, you know, this is, it's not just the United States. I mean, Italy is reopening aspects. So, you know, a country that has been hit as hard as any country on the planet. There are limits to what you can do with a lockdown, and there has to be a consideration of something more than the, you know, the fatality rate, you know, period. There's got to be more than that going into the mix. And I think everybody agrees with that. And then people will disagree on when do you start with this versus that, et cetera. And we're in a good position to try a bunch of different things.
Catherine, you have your finger on the pulse of upwardly mobile yuppie mothers in the District of Columbia. Where
but not literally, because we can't touch each other.
Yeah. Where are they at in terms of this? Like, what's the social feel in your cohort right now in terms of opening, closing, shaming people, not shaming people, and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the ongoing year of the Karen, which is something that we talked about a little bit a couple weeks ago. But, you know, this sort of question of like, what do we do? What is the obligation of a white middle-aged lady such as myself to enforce or not enforce norms using or not using the state? And, you know, the one of the objections to the Karen is that she is grumpy and angry and will also call your manager and then the cops if she doesn't get what she wants. And the Karen is generally not my preferred model of existence. But I think mask shaming is something that is really happening in DC right now. I had like an afternoon last week where my go ahead and just laugh all you want. My text thread with my book club suddenly had like four different posts of like mask shaming incidents. You know, one of them was out jogging and a person pulled over in their car and said, like, "You're killing me," to this woman who was jogging in open air near no one. They like stopped and rolled down their window and said that.
The person in the car was killing themselves by exposing themselves.
Right. So this is like this is the kind of thing, because people are not and are not really expected to be totally up on the exact way in which masks work. The CDC didn't help anything, did they, by utterly confusing the American public about how masks work. The notion of wearing a mask to protect others versus protect yourself, totally confused and buzzwazzled in this world. Again, thanks to the CDC, but also people just don't know. So I feel like the tolerance for social shaming right now is getting lower rather than higher, which is bad, because I would rather in the end still have people kind of guided by their own instincts and by the instincts of, you know, their neighbors or their peers, rather than calling in a third party to arbitrate the dispute, because that third party is going to be a police officer who is no better equipped, who also doesn't really know the answer to, am I allowed to jog without a mask? Because as Nick said, we don't really know the answers yet to where exactly the transmission risks are, because this is a, as they always say in the news reports, novel coronavirus.
Yeah. Ronald Bailey.
We just don't know. We just don't know. I wish I could say, yeah, everybody go outside, it's fine. But we don't know.
Suderman, you might be, I think, the most paranoid about this on the podcast, although I might compete with you on that, but I'm less paranoid than other people around me. Do you think that some of the my 11-year-old daughter like came back from a neighborhood walk and she reported to me that people were not keeping an appropriate social distance on the sidewalk from her? And I had to like, dude, you got a mask. You just walk by them. You're not going to get it from. Anyways, Suderman, how much do you think the discussion about reopening is in a way like people just like desperate for something to look forward to?
Oh, that's definitely it. I mean, people are very frustrated with their current situations, even people who are in relatively okay situations, people who have space, people who don't, you know, aren't trying to parent while also working a full-time job, people who are basically healthy and are, you know, employed and things are, you know, what they're mainly losing is the ability to say, go see their friends or go out to bars and restaurants. Everyone is feeling tense and anxious about this. And part of that is, as Catherine said, a result of how little we know here. We know that this is not the flu, that it kills many more people than the flu, whether that's because it has a higher death rate or whether it's just because many more people are getting it. More people are dying because of this. We have some sense that outdoor transmission is less common than indoor transmission, though this finding is at least somewhat unclear and preliminary. You know that reopening, no matter when we do it, no matter how we do it, is going to be difficult and complex. What if you reopen businesses and no one comes out? What if you reopen businesses and people do come out, but then there's a second wave of infection? What about the smaller scale micro problems? Like if there's a pocket of infections at a specific school, say, all the kids are still fine, but some of the adult, say, faculty or workers, this was an issue that was raised. I was talking to a state policy advisor recently, and this person said basically that their concern with schools was not the kids, and it was not even really the faculty, who tend to be somewhat younger, but the fact that schools are often staffed, the cafeteria workers, the bus drivers, even some of the administrators are often staffed by older workers who are really quite at risk, and they're not quite sure what to do. We just don't know how this thing works. We don't know how it kills. We don't know how it spreads. We have all these reports now that are coming out of relatively young and healthy people, people in their 30s and 40s, who appear to have either very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all, having strokes and in some cases dying. We have a medical debate about whether this attacks the blood, about whether it's aerosolized and just hangs in the air and you can just get it by walking around. And if so, how much and for how long? And so I at least am proceeding at this point. I feel in some ways almost like I know less than I did a month ago or 6 weeks ago. I'm sure about less. I am proceeding from a place of radical uncertainty about both the virus itself and about the appropriate policy response and about the appropriate personal response. And I think that sort of suggests a policy of caution for people who make laws, but also for individuals, that you should take precautions and you should watch out for yourself and your family and figure out what level of risk you are willing to take, but that you should try to do it. And this is a thing that I've been thinking about a lot this last week. Be cautious, take precautions, but try to do it without fear. And I think that's probably the place we all need to try and get to. It's pretty hard these days.
Well, I think I agree with all of that. And, you know, I think it draws on what Catherine was saying of, you know, there is an individual responsibility here. You don't want to knowingly infect people or expose people or yourself to a problem. But I think, you know, the scope for individual action needs to be expanded. And, you know, we need to start saying to individual business owners, to individual people, workers, employees, you know, just residents, not even citizens, to say, okay, you have more control over what you do with your day. You know, I come back to last week, I talked to Ovik Roy, who runs a think tank in Austin, Texas, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, which came out with a plan about opening up the economy again. And one of the bits in that conversation in their plan that I think is worth thinking about is that, you know, if we're stretching it, maybe 40% of Americans, you know, and it's closer to probably 20 or 25% can work from home kind of full time. That leaves a ton of people who are really screwed. And we cannot sustain, you know, Peter has talked about this a lot. It's mind-boggling, the unemployment benefits that are being paid out now. There's no way we can sustain that as a society, as a government, as a printing press. We are going to have to move back into a world where the novel coronavirus might be a fact of nature for, you know, the next 6 months, the next 8 months, the next 10 months, you know, whatever.
I mean, maybe the next 2 years.
And I think that, yeah, and you know, who knows if and when there might be treatment or a vaccine that is effective. But, you know, we are getting to a place where we need to start expanding the scope of individual activity. And then, you know, I think there is an ethics there, which is fully compliant with a kind of libertarian understanding. But, you know, we are all absorbing the risk now. Let us now have some exercise or control over exercising how much of that we take on.
Can I make a totally pessimistic prediction?
Yep.
So I think that what's going to happen is that schools are going to be too cautious to reopen in the fall, which is in at least some places, in places where there are high infection rates maybe, and that will therefore absolutely maximize the disruption, because in fact, in the early fall, things will probably be at a lull, if I had to guess, which I'm just guessing because I don't know anything, as previously discussed, that actually early fall will be the safest time to be out and about, and that schools will then reopen in January, right as we are all getting slammed by the second wave, and it will be a giant mess. That, like, it will be the same as the way at least DC public schools handle snow days, which is to say they will wind up closed when it's raining and open as the blizzard hits. And this is the kind of, you know, attempts to time cycles, which which government entities and really any large institutions struggle with, which is really, really hard to do. So I'm just predicting that that is how schools are going to go, at least in D.C., and that we will perfectly mistime the cycle of the second wave if there is a second wave.
If there's, you know, the countervailing tendency in education, and it's not K through 12, but through colleges and universities, Christina Paxson, the president of Brown, had a piece in the New York Times over the weekend calling for the opening of colleges in the fall. I've talked to a bunch of people I know who work at or are deans at institutions of higher education. For many self-interested reasons, but also, I think, disinterested reasons, everybody in higher ed is pushing for a reopening of campuses in the fall. And I think, hopefully, that will, at the very least, spur a serious conversation about, you know, both what are the risks, and then, as important, I think, particularly from a libertarian perspective, who gets to choose the risk level that they take on. And this will call for, you know, faculty and staff who are older and are more at risk. How do you not force them into a situation they're unwilling to take on? I think that's that's an interesting debate to have within institutions and whatnot, including public and private and all of that. But I'm hopeful that the higher ed people, partly because they need the money, partly because their student body is, you know, seemingly least at risk for all sorts of negative outcomes, they're going to force a really serious discussion about reopening society in a way that puts the onus on individuals to choose how much risk or how little they take on.
Okay, let's go to our end of podcast binge watching exercise or whatever else we've been doing on a cultural sphere. I'm going to go first in case that my esteemed culture gobblers that I podcast with have more intelligent things to say about it. But we, as part of our ongoing family movie night, watched the Academy Award winning animated feature Spirited Away by Hayao Miyazaki. And I'm sorry for pronouncing that wrong.
It's so good.
It is so good, people. It is oftentimes brought up in discussions of best animated movies of all time. It's the only one, I think, from Studio Ghibli to win an Academy Award. It was distributed in America on Pixar. It's hard to find now. All the Studio Ghibli stuff, I think you could basically only buy it. We might have just bought it off of Amazon. There aren't really good rental or Netflixable ways to get at it. As far as I know, you might want to research that. But anyways, kind of impossible to describe. Starts with a 10-year-old girl moving to a new place, a single child, obviously kind of bummed out about it, in the backseat of a car. And then they go through a portal and it's a world. And then there's parents turning into pigs, and it's pretty dark and weird and beautiful and awful and terrifying. My 5-year-old, probably a little bit too much for her, although she proclaims that she loved it. So I would put the age at around 7 or 8, maybe, for you common sense media consumers out there. But just hard to describe and wonderful, poetic, and nicely, like, you know, if this was Disney or something else like that, you know, if this was Inside Out, this would tell you we're doing a metaphor here about someone moving into their new house and city and being upset about this. And no, it's just kind of crazy and beautiful. And I'm also bringing this up because I responded to someone on Twitter saying, what's the best thing that you've watched in the quarantine era, like with your family? And my thing was Spirited Away. And it's the only thing that I can get Justin freaking Amash to respond to me with, not like, hey, dude, are you running for president? And he's like, oh, that's a great film. Like, thanks, Justin. If you guys have any more insight on
son of a bitch,
Hayao Miyazaki, whatever, that's great. Otherwise, Suderman, I toss the ball.
Netflix is streaming them, just not a bunch of the Ghibli films, just not in the United States. My favorite is, and I think the one that probably introduced me to that world of animation is Princess Mononoke, which is a little more, it's PG-13. It's not an R-rated film, but it's definitely more adult than Spirited Away. Probably not for very young kids, but it's this great kind of eco fantasy action film that had a really good localization in the United States with a pretty star-studded cast, with, I think, like Christian Bale and Billy Bob Thornton and folks like that, and actually very good American dub. And what I love about those films, and what sort of particularly I think about now, is just how connected they are to the natural world and to the experience of a kind. It's kind of a fantastical experience of nature, right? Which is a little bit, I think, of what some of us have been having recently when you go out into a park and, you know, or a green space and you're like,
seen.
It's like, wow, this is really sort of, it's like strangely nice. It's eerily nice in a way that Studio Ghibli has been capturing for a long time. I've been watching the third season of Westworld. It is an absolute mess of a show. It is beautiful. It looks super interesting. It has a bunch of interesting ideas and themes. The cast continues to be phenomenal. The show has always been kind of about control and liberation, and the tension between those two modes of existence. And in the most recent episode, it's episode 7 of 8. In season 3. So it's the penultimate episode. And so a lot of things are sort of revealed and resolved. We end up encountering a supercomputer in a facility for divergent people who are, you know, outliers, who can't be accounted for by the model that the other supercomputer is running. That is sort of that's the plan for the world to save it from disaster. And of course, Dolores, our liberationist revolutionary robot person, comes in and says, "Actually, we wanna have a system in which all of these people that you've taken off the grid because they don't comply, all of those people are allowed to have lives now." And so it's interesting in that it is an argument for outliers and an argument for a system that is more chaotic and more individualized. But the show itself is just so narratively fragmented in ways that are completely unnecessary. It cannot tell a straightforward story. It cannot just give us very basic characters with clear motivations and desires who then go out and enact those desires and try to and run into conflicts. And so it's really fascinating in certain ways, but it's kind of a mess. And I would really only recommend it. In some ways is just like, it's like a beautiful luxury car commercial, right? Just looking at it is interesting enough, I think, to keep me watching. But I think if you want a good, clear story, what this season has revealed to me is that the kind of fragmentary difficulty of the first two seasons wasn't just on purpose. It was that the folks who are writing this story just are kind of constitutionally incapable of being really clear about what's going on, who wants what, and why.
I agree with you, Peter, that the third season is really just pretty awful. I snorted some ketamine before I watched this most recent episode, and I was like, this is like a great episode, but I don't know if it was the drugs or not, to be quite honest.
Does it matter? I mean, if it gives you the experience you want, right? If the combination...
Yeah, no.
This was a drug cocktail, as they say.
I find with HBO and a number of other shows, you know, these kind of grand episodic, you know, masterworks, they really don't, they can't deliver. And that, you know, the pleasure that you can take from them is more like it opens up a world that you can wander around in. But then it's almost like Mario Castle or something, like where it's like, okay, this world is kind of interesting. It's not going anywhere. And then you just go on to the next one, hoping that it has that mix of creating a supplemental space that you can kind of imagine yourself in and actually a plot line that will keep you interested until it ends.
Nick, you want to sally forth?
Yeah. So jumping off of that, and this might have had something to do with the ketamine, I then watched Team America, which was also on HBO. It was streaming on HBO after that, the 2004 puppet movie, it's 16 years old. So that, and, you know, and it's about 9/11, and we've definitively left the 9/11 period behind and have entered into, you know, the pandemic era. It seems like it's from another planet. I mean, it is like it's from a different timeline. But having said that, Team America is worth watching. You know, it's done by the creators of South Park. And part of the reason is because it reminds us that even in dark periods, because this, it came out in 2004, it was filmed, you know, under very trying circumstances because it is a puppet movie, but it was, you know, kind of at the nadir of, you know, of I don't, maybe it's not nadir. It was filmed at the height of anti-war animus against the Bush administration, which was unsuccessful. We kept fighting. I mean, we're still fighting in Afghanistan, but the humor that it could derive from that situation, as well as moments of true feeling. And again, this is a puppet movie. I think it's for me, it was nice to watch that and recognize that we will be able to configure artistically and culturally, and I think ultimately on a kind of mass psychological level, a response to what we're going through that will help us learn something and actually just get on with our lives, if that makes sense.
It does. How does the puppet sex?
The version that's running on HBO, it's not the uncensored version. So it's kind of tasteful, to be quite honest. The puppet sex, and I know that if you were going to tell 25-year-old version of me, at some point you'll be on some kind of fucking weird, you know, asynchronous pod, you know, radio broadcasting thing called a podcast, and you're going to say the puppet sex was tasteful.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have believed you, Matt, and I still won't.
And you would have been happy. I want to plug Nick is going to appear on the Political Beats, the Great Political Beats podcast run by Jeff Blair, and hosted, I think, at National Review, and they're talking about The Birds with a Y, the band. Great podcast.
Oh, it was a real delight. Scott Bertram and Jeff are great hosts, and it's just The Birds also, we talk about it somewhat in the current context, and The Birds are tragic. I guess Jeff was talking about them as a kind of version of Icarus, really, that got close enough to the sun only to kind of lose their wings. But they're a beautiful band, and they encourage aspiration, I think, in all sorts of uniquely American ways. So thank you for bringing that
beautifully
up.
Beautifully put. Catherine, take us home. What have you been consuming, robot?
So I have been rewatching Firefly, which
yes.
Is absolutely a like comfort watch nostalgia move on my part. It's pretty good. I would say, like, we've talked, I think, on this podcast before, and we'll probably talk again about the Joss Whedon lady problems, which remain abundant, but also interesting. Like, his version of the strong woman, of which there are, like, the three sub-genres of the sexy strong woman, the swashbuckling strong woman, and the strong woman who totally surprisingly has a brain. They're all in that show, and it's moderately annoying. However, the concept remains super solid. Smugglers in space, that's also a Western. Love it. So good. And I would definitely recommend a rewatch to anyone who's just looking to live in a different universe. But the real thing that I'm consuming is an email that I received yesterday, which honestly just like warmed my heart. It is the most charming thing that has happened in a long time in my
inbox. You have a heart.
Shut up. Shut up. And it is from a person who asked to remain anonymous and who sent me this very nice note that basically said his pal is turning 35. He's, you know, in quarantine. He's bummed. He's a big libertarian reader, consumer. He loves talking about libertarian ideas. He loves reason. And this dude just emailed and said, like, hey, could you maybe give a shout out or say hi to my friend Carl Doge? So I just want to say hi to Carl Doge. Your unnamed friend sent me such a lovely email about you that said you were a coder and an ultimate Frisbee legend. Story checks out.
Wow.
Reason consumers wow, have a high Frisbee overlap. And Carl is turning 35 today. And I guess I just wanted to like particularly point out that it's super cool that this friend does not seem to be a libertarian, does not seem to be a Reason reader particularly, and just knew that his pal Carl was a fan of ours and would love some kind of Reason engagement. So there you go. Carl Doge. It's his 35th birthday and he's in quarantine like all of us. So I hope this makes it a slightly better birthday.
See, happy birthday,
I'm
Carl.
Nice.
Happy
I like
birthday,
it when other
Carl.
People are nice. Happy birthday, Carl.
Gains from nice trade. I just want to say about the ultimate frisbee thing that Carl is no stranger to the bong, most likely. I once
we don't no. know. You don't know.
I
that.
Was nah, yeah.
This now that now we're getting to the interesting part of the podcast where we start talking about drugs.
Did you stop talking about drugs?
Never.
I don't know, Matt. I can't hear you. I have this tinnitus from.
I was once interviewed by someone from the State Department to do a character reference on a guy who still works there. And this it's
John Bolton.
His name is John Bolton. I wish. Who I know a long time ago, and the guy, and they asked the question like, "So you knew this person? Did this person ever take illegal narcotics drugs?" And I'm like. See, how do I answer this? Am I under oath? Do I want to? I'm like, well, let's just say he played ultimate frisbee, and then we're allowed to.
Oh man! you ruined it. He had to join ISIS. That's the only way he's getting into international politics.
Thankfully, he's making the world safer for democracy. And that's all the democracy we have time to say on today's Reason Roundtable podcast. Keep listening to our crap and our good stuff too, especially over at the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie and on Soho Forum. Is up there. They're doing like the distance forums. It's great.
There was a great debate about whether or not government lockdown should end. It went up on Friday.
Yeah.
So it's up there. Yeah.
Go to reason.com/podcasts to get your full fill of all of it. And thanks again. And we will see you next Monday. Goodbye.